VentureCast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Pulled up some planks and then went down in there. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing?
Shit.
And he was like, I get high down here. I drink down here and listen to music loud down here. And I was like, I mean, I'm like a little tiny kid. And I was like, that sounds worrisome to me. And I'll never forget this. I gave him like the sort of the standard, like, you know, the don't do drugs speech, but it didn't do any good at all. Anyhow, I was like, well, you know, basically like, what about your parents and what about school? And he was like, fuck those people. And I remember it so vividly. I was like, wait, what? Because first of all, I was like, this is a version of reality where you're just like, no, I'm just going to stop doing all the shit they tell me to do. Like, not some of it. Like, I'm out in the entire fucking project of being what people tell me to be.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
At our podcast has expanded. We're bringing in more workers. What with the windfall we have been seeing here in the second season.
It's all about growth and expansion. This is an American podcast.
That's right. Bigger. That's right. So we are 50 Years of Music on the Music City Drive-In Podcast Network. Check out musiccitydrivein.com for all your podcasting needs in the world of movies, music, entertainment, and at this time of year, fantasy football. You should know that I relied on them heavily with my Patrick Mahomes auction pick.
Oh, nice. Yeah, you had your draft. Are you happy with your team?
Yeah, I'm happy with my team. I think running backs are overrated, so I kind of ignored that particular position.
I don't know much about fantasy football, but is that like saying Boston's not a big college town?
That's quite right. But okay. I wouldn't worry about it. It's not a college town. Ben Barton, how are things in Knoxville?
Bumping along. Very nice. We have the tragic news.
Oh, no.
That Bonnaroo canceled.
I cannot believe this. Yeah.
My daughter, Dale, was like, I was going to pick her up 12:30 on Thursday and drive her to Bonnaroo. We were going to like spend the weekend together, and Indy was going to come. And now I will just stay home. It'll be good. I'm an elderly man. That'll be fun.
But good for the good people of Tennessee to recognize the dangers at this time in our country, and that COVID, the best way to stop it is
No luck, Timmy. It's apparently they've got like a foot of standing water multiple places on the farm. So they just couldn't accommodate the people.
Jeff, Ben said it wasn't COVID as much as a fear of a malaria outbreak because of all the standing water.
Yeah, that's disgusting and accurate. Can you imagine?
I've been there and it is true. And the thing is that like having been there and seen the people who go there, they would be like, I can put my tent in this foot of standing water. That'll be fine.
You have to force people not to do that to themselves. Like, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. And it would really be like Papillon by the end of the weekend.
By the way, I mean, a foot of standing water, that's why you have a tarp. That's what the tarp's for.
Yeah, right? Take care of it. All right. Well, I am excited for 1979. We're closing out the 1970s.
Yeah. Yes! Good riddance. Happy to see them go.
An ugly, ugly decade. Ben was just talking about The Verdict, Jeff Simons. Do you remember The Verdict?
Paul Newman. Yeah. I remember it well.
Great movie, but boy, are there some bad clothes. Bad architecture, ugly cars.
The cars are so ugly. Whenever I watch a 1970s movie, I'm like, did they, I mean, they weren't even trying to design cars. They were like four wheels, engine, and then whatever metal and is left over will just surround those parts with it. And then you could just drive your ass around in that. Yep. Like, it's just shocking how ugly they were.
You know, when I try and explain to people, like, thank goodness this has ended. But I mean, Timmy, do you remember the Irish breakfast that he has?
Yeah.
He's playing pinball at a bar at 8:30 in the morning before he has trial at 9.
Yeah.
And the Irish breakfast is a raw egg dumped into a beer that he just chugs.
Yeah.
And the students are like, good Lord, did people actually do that? I'm like, well, at least it wasn't the Boilermaker. I mean, like,
right. Like,
he skipped the shot. So good news for him. He's going to be crisp and clear.
He's doing well. Well, we're going to say goodbye to 1979 in style. Jeff Simons, did you get the text I sent you? Once again, we have a Grammy-winning album of the year that was also the best-selling album of that year.
Oh, it just makes me... It's just killing me.
And Jeff Simons...
Here's to the worst of times. Oh, so bad. Do I get to pick the track?
I think you are in the perfect headspace to pick the track.
All right, I'm going to go with... Well,
you can do a couple.
I'll just do the one that, as I look at the first one, this is the one that I think we'll have the most fun making fun of. So we'll start with this one. Here we go.
It's the Grammy winner. It's the number one album.
52nd Street by Billy Joel.
Oh. I mean, are you feeling the rock and roll, Tim? This guy is a hard rocking son of a bitch. Wait. Here comes. Oh, now we're grooving. Maybe a little piano right here. What do you say?
Oh, don't get too spicy.
Oh, a little B3. And then bring it, Bill.
She cuts you once, she cuts you twice. Still you believe. The wound is so fresh, you can taste the blood, but you don't have strength to leave.
Can we just talk about that lyric?
Yeah.
The wound is so fresh, you can taste the blood, but you don't have the strength to leave. You've been bought, you've been sold, you've been thrown outside the door. You stand there shaking with your insides aching because you know you want some more. That's a classic Billy Joel love song. Like this horrible.
This is Glass Houses? What record is this?
52nd Street.
52nd.
Where I believe he's holding a flugelhorn on the cover.
Sure, why not? Who doesn't flugelhorn?
In the alley of the
what
of
is 52nd Street. What's the biggest hit off of this album?
Oh, what isn't Big Shot, My Life? I guess those are the big two. Honesty.
Okay. Oh, I don't like that one.
Stiletto, Rosalinda's Eyes, Zanzibar. I actually weirdly like this record. I don't even care. I'm looking so at weird. The track list. I'm like, I like this.
It's such a weird record. It's such an angry, misogynist, self-loathing record that was a gigantic hit because people, I don't know, I guess that's how people felt in 1979, but like everybody thinks this is a fun sing-along record. These songs are so mean.
He does the car sounds on Moving Out. That's always fun when you have car sounds.
No, dude, you're going back to The Stranger, which I can't wait. I'm going to discuss again tonight, by the way.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. You can't get away from The Stranger, so you set me up nicely for it.
So my students, did I tell you my rock band students gave me a fake Billy Joel autograph for my birthday?
It was so great, so funny.
Why is this the Grammy winner? Like, what's going on? What is the Grammy committee, Grammy voters seeing? Because his first two albums weren't big successes. Has he made some sort of artistic leap?
No, The Stranger was a big hit. And then Glass
Houses
is
the breakthrough.
After, like, doesn't it go Strangers, Glass Houses, this record? Or
no, it goes Strangers, this record, Glass Houses.
What about where's Turnstiles?
Turnstiles is before The Strangers.
Okay, that was not a hit. He had a series of not hits, and then The Stranger really leaped him. And then it's basically like, it's one of those ones where The Stranger's a better record, but 52nd Street is also good, has a bunch of, and so honestly, just to be clear, this would not even touch the 10 worst Grammy-winning songs.
No question.
Like, there's a couple of good songs on this record. And they, I mean, some of these Grammy winning songs were just jaw dropping. That being said, you will recall when we discussed Michael Jackson, he was heartbroken. Heartbroken that he did not win a Grammy for Off the Wall, which is laugh out loud funny when he's like, if only I had done 52nd Street.
You know, right? That's the same year.
Like, you really wish that that poor guy had been like, oh, I didn't win a Grammy, but the Grammys must suck because
52nd
Street. Like, my record's amazing and 52nd Street is not.
You know, the thing that pisses me off about Billy Joel is none of these songs are bad. I mean, that's the thing that's really frustrating. It's like that great melodies fall out of that guy's head by accident, and he can play and he can sing. I think his singing is a little bit posturing, and he's like a little growly bear. He's like if the Charmin Bear's son became a rock star. Like, he's just this like little bear cub. Like, he's like Scrappy Doo became a rock star. Like, but he's really talented, and these songs are really put together. But they just like, they don't coalesce into any, like, they don't mean anything to me. And I just such a bummer. Like, he just sounds like a dick song after song on this record, you know? I don't feel for him when she's like, she cut me with her stiletto. I'm like, I'm sure she had a really good reason to do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
that's a good
that's
joke.
How I feel.
What exactly did you say to her?
What part you played in this drama?
I know exactly. Exactly.
Oh my God, that's terrible. All right. Well, that there it is. That's the Grammy winner. That is the number one selling album of the year. Jeff Simons. It is not, however, the number one selling album of all time, released in 1979.
And that is Pink Floyd's The Wall.
It
right?
is indeed. Yeah. Have we covered Pink Floyd enough?
Well, I'll just get a hot take.
Weird. When does the movie come out?
82. It's not for another 3 years that the movie comes out.
Because my record, I mean, I had no idea it came out in 79. I thought it came out. I mean, because basically for me, when the movie came out, it was gargantuan. Like, like it was really, it was inescapable. Wasn't that your experience of it? Like,
yeah.
It was inescapable in school. And there were a bunch of people who were like, have you seen the movie? It's amazing. I was like, yeah, I've seen it. I can't agree on your take on that for sure.
It's the first time I've ever seen a guy shave his eyebrows.
Hey. Oh, dude, forget the eyebrows. It was the nipples. I still have freaking nightmares about him shaving his nipples off. Like,
so unacceptable.
It's totally unacceptable. Seriously, I was like, I think I find that more disturbing than The Shining. Like, I mean, that was so bad.
So I have no idea. I never saw this film. So I'm disturbed by this whole conversation, and I would like to move on.
Okay.
All right. It is 1979, and there is a Music for UNICEF concert that takes place at the United Nations General Assembly. Oof. And it is broadcast.
Great place for a show.
It is broadcast.
By the way, those UN people, get down. One thing was a problem. Some of them were trying to jump over the rope to get in. But fortunately, you know, they had good roadies and they just kept pushing them back.
Yeah. All the translators are pushing back the actual ambassadors.
No, and also it was like really the Eritrea group. They were just completely off the hook.
So it is at the UN. It's broadcast on NBC TV from 8 to 9:30. And you guys are going to try to tell me who performed at this particular concert without looking anything up. And your hint is, well, I guess there are a couple of hints. It's the late 70s. It's on NBC. And the hosts are Gilda Radner and Henry Winkler.
What in the world?
Go ahead, Jeff. Name a performer, band, or singer at this concert.
Oh, my God. The Captain and Tennille.
That's actually an excellent guess. They are not there. Sorry. Ben, what do you got?
How about the Bee Gees?
The Bee Gees are there. Excellent.
I can't believe I might win one of these stupid things. Amazing.
That's right.
Let's play to three. Jeff Simons. If the
Debbie
Bee Gees
Boone.
Are... What?
Debbie Boone.
Not there.
Okay.
All right, I've got a Henry Winkler shout out. I'm sure I'm wrong, but give me Sha-na-na.
Oh, that's Sha-na-na. So fantastic. Please
give me
right.
Sha-na-na. I want so bad.
Sha-na-na is not there. No.
Oh, God.
But Jeff, if the Bee Gees are there.
Are you saying another disco group is there? Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Earth, Wind, and Fire is indeed there.
Yes.
One to one.
They might stay one to one, man. I don't even know who to guess.
How about Barry Gibb? Like, don't we get one of the Gibbs?
I'm gonna give you Andy Gibb, the little brother.
Perfect. There,
that I was and looking I will for.
Guess. I'll guess the other Barry. I'll guess Barry Manilow is there.
No, but if you follow that Barry Manilow tree to the acoustic guitar, you might get this performer.
Ooh.
Timmy, while he's thinking, can I say, is it too late for me to lodge a complaint about Sha Na Na? I feel like I don't know what they were thinking. Why is Sha Na Na not there with Henry Winkler announcing this? Come on now.
Did Sha Na Na have a variety show that was on for a little while?
It was like the Muppet show,
but it was Sha Na Na guys instead of Muppets, and they would do like a couple of 50s.
They've got a contract with ABC or something like that.
Oh, that's what got us.
Yeah. All right.
Good corporate law there, Tim.
You ever seen the Woodstock footage of Sha Na Na? It is the most hilarious "what are we doing here" I've ever seen a band experience.
Honestly, Jeff, that's how I experienced them every time. Every time I saw them, they looked like they were like, this is a puzzle. Why do people like this?
I know.
All right. So here are some people I feel you should have gotten at this Music for UNICEF concert. I think you should have gotten John Denver.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I think you should have gotten Olivia Newton-John.
Oh, that's an obvious one. I apologize.
Yeah, boo us.
There's a Rita Coolidge, Kris Kristofferson duet.
Superstar.
That would have taken me a long time, Timmy. we would have had another 50 years before I came up with that combo.
Donna Summer.
Nice.
And ABBA.
Oh, wow.
That's a hell of a lineup.
And Do You Think I'm Sexy?
Rod Stewart staying relevant in the most unfortunate way possible.
Exactly.
What a show.
All right. Well, that was not our invitation to cynicism. Our invitation to cynicism is going to be in the world of fictional TV, episodic TV. Gentlemen, The Dukes of Hazzard comes out in 1979. Their car, the General Lee, had a Confederate flag painted on the roof.
And it played Dixie on the horn, too, in case you're wondering.
Did we miss that? Like, what? How did this
in
get
the
okay?
Same year, guys, in the same year as this debut is a little movie called The Muppet Movie that came out in 1979.
Yes.
And when they go to the state, then they go to the fair and meet Gonzo, everyone's holding Confederate flags. Huh. That's the little flags that all the kids are being handed out and waved to. Richard Pryor hands a Confederate flag to a kid as the balloon salesman in the Muppet movie.
Does he say anything about it?
Crazy 1979 is. No, I believe Richard Pryor asks for his payment in cocaine and disappears into the forest.
I just finished driving my beloved older daughter, Dahlia, up to Havre for college.
Uh-huh.
And you take a long drive on 81 that includes passing Cooter's, which is a restaurant by Cooter.
Right. Yes.
And it's co-advertised to the Dukes of Hazzard Museum. And my attempt to explain the Dukes of Hazzard to Dahlia was just like, literally, like I was talking in a completely foreign language from 500 years ago. I was like, there's this show and there's white guys and they drive in a car with the flag on it. And they have to fight against an evil boss hog. But there's
He's a hot girl, a southern gentleman.
Short shorts. And Dahlia was like, all of these things make no sense. Like, there's nothing you said. And
well, then you she left was that like, Roscoe funny, P. Coltrane.
No, dude, I went on for 5 minutes and she was like, I hate this story. And you didn't tell me who Cooter was. And I was like, good point. Thank you. That's fair. That's fair. Good feedback for me.
Oh, my God. Did you tell her about John Schneider? I mean, really, that's all you got to know.
Yeah.
John Schneider. You see, what they did was they'd slide across the hood of their car when they were being chased. It was really cool.
I just remember spending most of my 20s whenever I faced a difficult situation, I would say in my head, is this Duke boy going to make it? Let's wait and find out.
All right. I'm going to remember that forever, Jeff Simons, because I remember whenever that stupid song comes on, you walking into a gas station and finding the candy bar you want and making... What sound do you make?
I don't remember.
You go, yeah.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. No. All right. Well, we'll figure this out later.
It used to be fun. That made me feel good, Tim.
All right. Tough transition. Sid Vicious dies.
Which is not a surprise, to be honest.
He's put away for 55 days in a detox treatment jail situation, right?
I believe that's correct.
And then he's released and is dead by midnight that night.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that.
Of a heroin overdose. I would say that it didn't take.
I was going to say, I don't think they had Sid Vicious on the wall of that treatment center. Like, people we've helped.
They definitely did not have the customer appreciation from him.
What did he, was he the guitarist of the band?
No, he was nothing. He was the bass player, but he actually couldn't play. The Sex Pistols fired the original bass player, Glenn Matlock, for admitting in a music magazine that he liked the Beatles. And also they fire him because he was the actual only musician of the band and the rest of the guys were jealous. They bring in Sid Vicious just because of the way he looks. And he just stood on stage and kind of whapped at the bass. Like he couldn't play it at all.
Wow.
And he's actually, there's a really, he's just a tragic figure of, you know, he's probably the first kind of straight fame reality TV casualty. Like death, it anticipates, like, I'll go on Fear Factor and eat bugs for money. I just want to be famous. I just want to be famous.
Right.
You know.
Well, that ain't good. Well, do you want to hit us with your movie segment? To Ben
I was
get
just trying
to
help out. I was just trying to help out that. Yeah, no, I'm going to ask you. I just remember that 1979 was the year I really started going to the movies pretty regularly with my parents. And I remember I saw a lot of really awful movies. Okay. So I'm going to give you the names of really successful directors.
Okay.
And you're going to try to remember the terrible movie they made in 1979.
I'm
so fair?
Excited. Yeah, let's go.
First up is Curtis Hanson. The man who made L.A. Confidential and a couple of other really good movies.
Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
No, good guess. It's an action comedy where a grandfather takes his two young grandsons on a camping trip for their karate tournament, and they become involved in a kidnapping by a poor country family that lives in the woods.
Wow.
Dragons.
Oh my God.
Okay.
I don't remember that.
What could go wrong? That sounds hilarious.
My second pick is Steven Spielberg's 1979.
This is 1942.
1941.
That movie's awful.
Hysterical Californians prepare for a Japanese invasion in the days after Pearl Harbor. John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, Treat Williams. By the way, 7 of these movies have Nancy Allen in them. And when I was doing this research, like, she's in all of these movies. Unbelievable.
That movie is mysteriously bad.
Yeah, right?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. It's the movie he made right after Jaws, too.
Yeah, he could have made anything in the world and he made that. And then actually, it's why we get Raiders.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Wait, why?
So 1941 was such a bomb. Lucas had to get him the gig for Raiders. After Star Wars, the first thing George Lucas did was look out for my boy Spielberg. We've got another project. And they worked together on it, and Lucas guided him on it and put his career back on track. Basically, in the 70s, you all recall, they would let anybody make anything. And then it would be a huge hit. They'd be like, awesome, keep going. But then as soon as they put out a piece of crap, they would be like, well, you know, slow down there. So, yeah.
So Close Encounters of the Third Kind is 77, which is Spielberg, which was a big hit and which is the slowest movie in the universe. If
you're watching it
in 2021, you're like,
there's a special edition that added 30 minutes of extra footage inside the spaceship. And I'm just like, how is that even possible?
I still really like that movie. Yeah.
I really did too. And I made my kids watch it and they will never trust me again. It was that slow. No patience for it.
Can you name the movie that Jonathan Demme made in 1979?
Can you give us a little hint?
It stars Roy Scheider and Janet Margolin.
Oh my God, is this Blue Thunder?
It is not. It is Last Embrace. Harry breaks down and loses his job after his wife is assassinated. Is his turn next?
Roy Scheider's another great one, man. You look at his IMDb after Jaws, and he could have made any movie he wanted, and it's really straight downhill.
Yeah,
I was going to go and say that Blue Thunder is a highlight of his post-Jaws IMDb.
I'll just do a couple quickly. Robert Altman made two unwatchable movies in 1979. My favorite stars Paul Newman, and it's called Quintet. During a future Ice Age, dying humanity occupies its remaining time playing a board game called Quintet. For one small group, this obsession is not enough. They play the game with living pieces, and only the winner survives.
Nice!
This is a 138-minute R-rated film I have never heard of.
Thank you, Paul Newman. Good job.
Wow.
It was the year of 2.5-hour unwatchable movies. The first Star Trek movie before The Wrath of Khan comes out. That's enough. But it's amazing, like, Brian De Palma makes an unwatchable movie in 79. David Cronenberg makes another unwatchable movie. Like, a lot of famous. And then this movie I need to find. It's called Golden Girl, and it stars Susan Anton and James Coburn.
The description is
a neo-Nazi doctor tries to make a superwoman of his daughter who has been specially fed, exercised, and conditioned to prepare for the Olympics.
Oh my God.
With James Coburn.
Where has that been my whole life? I cannot wait to watch Golden Girl.
That's a $6 million man spinoff kind of. Yeah. I'll tell you what, though. One of the most tear-jerking movies ever comes out in 1979.
Oh, Coming Home?
No, I was thinking The Champ.
Oh, Jesus, that movie.
With Ricky Schroeder going
Rick
in.
Rick Schroeder and John Voight when he breaks his fist on the cement wall. Yeah, that's unacceptable, that movie.
Wake up, champ. Wake up. He's not going to wake up. All right, let's get to our three albums.
Our three albums.
Ben, you're up.
Okay. So I said that there were going to be some albums that were irresistible, regardless of how much we talked about them. This is one of them. I have chosen to do no research. Jeff already covered the recording of this album. I'm going to say nothing about the recording of this album. I'm going to tell a long personal story about my memory of this album. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. And I guess you guys have had this exact experience probably now on the other side where your parents. I have no idea how it is that my brother and I came to be friends with these two people. And I'm gonna just refer to this guy as my buddy because I don't want to, like, some of the stuff that happens, I don't want to say him by name.
Okay.
Anyhow, it's basically my recollection is, like, we were friends with this family in preschool. And, like, when you're a little tiny kid, it's like there's a family friend and they have kids the same age as you. And they're just like, you're friends. And we were like, we're friends. And so we, like, hung out, and I got to be really, really, really close friends with this particular guy. And my brother was less close friends with his younger brother, but this guy was basically my best friend all the way through elementary school and on into middle school. And we had a lovely time. We did Lego. And then when we got older, we did, like, computer games on the, like, he had the early version of the Mac
and television
D&D together. I had Intellivision. He had the
nice
computer. So we were just buddies. And through sixth grade, I went to public school. First to fifth grade, we went to a lovely little elementary school right there in Park Slope, which was actually kind of a medium bad neighborhood in the 70s. But this elementary school kind of held it together. Then we joined the much bigger pond of the middle school, IS-88. And sixth grade was super rough. Like, I got mugged several times. I got beaten up. They took my bus pass. They threw me down a flight of stairs. Like, it was super tough to the point where my parents pulled me. And then my buddy's parents pulled him out and sent us to Brooklyn Friends. This is the first time I'd ever gone to public school, private school. And we went there for seventh and eighth grade. And it was a whole different experience of 70s New York. So sixth grade experience of 70s New York was like the Mean Streets version of 70s New York. Like, it was just a super, super, super rough and tumble, poverty-stricken school with a lot of different people in it trying to get along. The Brooklyn Friends was like the 70s on steroids, bunch of rich kids from Brooklyn Heights, some of them from Manhattan. And so I arrived in seventh grade and there were, like, actual cocaine parties at middle school. Like, it was completely off the hook. There were kids having sex. There were kids really getting into it. So, and I was still going by my childhood moniker of Benji. So I'm like Benji Barton.
Aww.
And I was like a little pudgy baby fat kid. And I mean that both literally and figuratively. Like, that was what I was like. I was still a really little kid. And one of the things that's really hard about middle school is like people age differentially. So at the same time, my buddy, so another thing that you remember when you're a little tiny kid is like you spend time at somebody else's house and you just expect everyone's house to be your house. You're like, their mom must be my mom. Their dad will be my dad. Like, all of these people will behave in the same way. And then when they're different, you're like, well, that was weird. Like, I had no idea. There's other people who behave in this other way. So this is a bless their heart situation. My parents are passionate people. They've been married more than 50 years. They're fighters. They are fighters. And they would fight all the time in front of me and my brother. They would yell at each other. But at heart for it, and I don't know if my brother would agree, but there was love there. And they've stayed married. So the proof is in the pudding. Dude, my buddy's parents would fight and there was not love there. It was really, really, really ugly 70s style fighting where they were like that. The heart of their argument was hatred. Like, they couldn't stand each other and they went after each other. And I'm not speculating because this occurred multiple times in front of me.
In front of you.
Where I'm like a 9-year-old kid. And I'm like, that really got out of hand. Like, those, like, I thought that like in houses, people liked each other, but apparently in this house, they don't like each other.
Man.
They had a really ugly divorce, super hard on my buddy. And again, this was one of those things similar to what we were saying about Springsteen with the mental health stuff. Like, nobody talked about it. Like, I didn't talk to my buddy about it. I wasn't like, that must have been really hard for you when your parents divorced. But even more importantly, I wasn't like, that must have been really hard for you when your parents screamed at each other and at you in front of me. Like, that must have been a really hard thing for you. So now I'm going to get the years mixed up. London Calling comes out 79 in England, 80 in America. And so this is either summer 81 or summer 82. So the parents are divorced now, and because it's an ugly 70s divorce, you have to choose your side. So my parents stay friends with the dad, and so that's who I stay friends with. Like, I'm still over at the house, and they're still fighting with each other. And like, when the, you know, like, I'm over there and he's running down the kid's mom in front of me, and he's really, really, really hard on his kids, and in particular my buddy. He's just like yelling at my buddy and just really laying into him, like kind of Great Santini style. And again, now that I'm a grown-up, I'm like, I assume he went through some really hideous trauma and like he was sort of taking it out on his son.
Sure.
Now as a grown-up, I know this is a brilliant guy. At the time, he was pursuing his PhD in economics at Yale, and he ended up being ABD. He couldn't finish it, which I assume was now that I'm a grown-up, I'm like, that must have been a really upsetting, like harrowing experience for him to not be able to finish his PhD. As a little kid, you're like, I had no idea, except he's just yelling at my buddy all the time in front of him. So in a stroke of what he probably thought was genius, he's like, you know what we need? We need a family trip. So he takes my buddy and his brother over to England. And I'm going to get all these details mixed up, but basically they do a 6-week biking trip where like they start in Edinburgh and bike to London. And so he's like, this will be great. This will be a bonding experience for us. Turns out to be the opposite. So he's just like, they're and also you like, I was in middle school and I was kind of pudgy, and my buddy was like, I don't know about this at all. I was like, you're going to bike 20 miles a day with your dad who's a dick? Like, that's not going to work out at all. And I'm sad to report I was right about that, except insofar as his description of the trip was, my dad yelled at me a lot. And then every night I would leave and I go to the pub and I'd listen to punk music and I get drunk. So that's suboptimal for a middle school person.
He's in eighth grade. Yeah, right, totally. Now.
And I completely like, and you know how it is? Like, it wasn't like I didn't Instagram with him. I didn't text with him. I had no contact with this dude. He got on a plane with his dad. He went away. He came back utterly transformed. And you know, like in middle school, it's a little bit like this. Like every once in a while, like somebody will just be like, I'm a 12th grader. You know, like he came back, he had like a little peach fuzz. He had basically sort of kind of gone through partial puberty. He was just really in a clearly different life stage than me. But even more importantly, he came back with a fake mohawk, the faux hawk. His hair was all spiky. And I was like, what is up with your hair? And he's like, oh yeah, I crack raw eggs into my hair every day and stroke it up. So I've got the spiky hair.
Wow.
He came back with a rotating series of Sex Pistols and Clash and I guess the Damned and these other bands, all with the sleeves cut off. And he was so mad at his dad that, so they lived in a Park Slope brownstone, and his dad owned the whole building and rented out some of it. So when you do that, you break it apart into pieces, but you don't take out the stairways. The stairways sit there, but you can't, you have to cover the stairways because they're, you don't want people to go in between apartments. Oh, my buddy literally moved out of his dad's apartment, was like, I can't stand that guy. And he moved into a completely sealed in stairway. It was like he moved into the Harry Potter place underneath the stairs. No,
except,
windows, no,
except a self-chosen dungeon. Not,
right. And, yeah. And so he like comes back from the trip. He's like a huge punker, like out of no, I mean, he and I were in AC/DC and stuff, but I mean, he was like super into punk rock, completely changed. And he was like, come to my place now. So we go into this little thing. And I was like, this is weird, man.
Wait,
like,
how do you enter it? What do you mean?
He had a little trap door in his dad's room house where he like pulled up some thing planks and then went down in there. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing?
Shit.
And he was like, I get high down here. I drink down here and listen to music loud down here. And I was like, I mean, I'm like a little tiny kid. And I was like, that sounds worrisome to me. And I'll never forget this. I was like, you know what? Basically, like, what about your parents? And again, I kind of regret this a little bit because I feel like, I mean, I'm not being too hard on myself, but I wasn't empathetic enough. Like, I actually should have been like, wow, you seem to be in a lot of pain. Like, what's going on? Like, why would you choose to live in this windowless stairway?
What's happening?
By yourself, getting high every day? That strikes me as maybe like there's something you want to talk to me about. I gave him like the sort of the standard, like, you know, the don't do drugs speech, but it didn't do any good at all. Anyhow, I was like, well, you know, basically like, what about your parents and what about school? And he was like, fuck those people. And I remember it so vividly. I was like, wait, what? Because first of all, I was like, this is a version of reality where you're just like, no, I'm just going to stop doing all the shit they tell me to do. Like, not some of it. Like, I'm out in the entire fucking project of being what people tell me to be. And then second, like, that was his life statement. Like, that was his actual mission statement was fuck these people. And I mean, these people, he meant all of them. He was like, my mom, my dad, my teachers, you, fuck them all. It was amazing. Anyhow, he was like, I'm super into punk music now. And I was like, this I can see. And so I'm going to forget. Like, first he played me a Sex Pistols song, probably God Save the Queen. And I was like, well, that's not for me. That's too much. And then I think he probably played me White Riot by the Clash. And I was like, also too much. And then I remember vividly, he was like, okay, I know where you're coming from. You got to crawl before you walk. And he put on London Calling. And it was so loud, like the whole time, like we can't even talk during this. And he put on London Calling. The first notes of that, I was like, oh, okay, now. Like the really sloppy punk stuff was like an instrumental and emotional register I could not feel at all. Like I just had nothing for that material. Over time, I've sort of gotten a little bit warmer to it, but it still doesn't speak to my personal experience. For whatever reason, London Calling was like, oh, I was locked in. That record was freaking great and amazing. I so strongly associate that record with that moment and with my buddy, like his decision, like his life choices. It was really funny. Like, as you can imagine, he didn't hang out a lot with Benji Barton after that. Like, and he was fuck those people, including the popular people, but needless to say, that made him way more popular. You know what I mean? Like, being like, I don't care. And he got invited to all the cool parties. And it was a little bit weird because it was like, you know, he did all the stuff that I did much later. Like, he got a girlfriend much before I did. He started drinking a lot before I did. He started doing drugs a lot before I did. But, it was a real sour, bad fighting against your parents type thing.
Right.
And this brings me to the stranger. I have spent some time in my life being rebellious. It is true. I got in some trouble later in high school, but always with really strict guardrails. And humorously, the stranger is basically, that's the level that I'm at. Like the moving out, if that's what you're all about, right. That's what it means. I'm not doing it. And, you know, when the truth is told, you can get what you want, you just get old. Like, that's the level of rebellion where I'm at. I just never reach my buddy's level of rebellion. But anyhow, this was the first actual punk that I knew. And he was not posturing at all. Like, he was really, really, really into the lifestyle and into it, and to great dissatisfaction, I think. It's my understanding, since he's like, he's runs his own business in Brooklyn, he's gotten married, he's has a perfectly fine life. But I will always, always, always associate this record with that moment.
And what are we hearing? What do you want?
Guns or Brixton. Because when they kick in the front door, how are you going to come, Jeff? How are you going to come?
Your hands on your head or on the trigger of your gun.
London Calling by The Clash.
Good stuff. We all have our rebellious sides, but then some can say, fuck those people. Whereas my rebellion wouldn't involve any curse words. I would stay away from that because I wouldn't want to get in trouble.
No, your F word was football. I'm going out for football as a senior at 106 pounds or whatever you were, soaking wet. But
gosh darn it,
can't top that. I mean, Ben's right, this is the best record of 1979. I, you know, hearing you talk about it, I didn't go the whole way with the mohawk and the I never went for the look, but I definitely, there was no music really probably ever in my life that made me more determined to make my own decisions about stuff than punk rock. Like, from 81 to 86, it wasn't all I listened to, but it was as important to me as anything in my life was that punk rock music, because it was justifying my ambition in a really strange way. And the only way I got to do it was to hide in plain sight as somebody who wasn't it. Like, my old man would just not, he would have thrown me out of the house. So I had to look like that wasn't who I was, but I mean, I was living a secret double life for sure. And luckily it didn't get so bad with my folks that I had to go live under the stairs, but I lived an invisible second authentic life, you know, and it had like a school was fine. Thanks a lot. Yes. I'll have some more peas in front of that real life for a couple of years there. It took a while before I could put the authentic self out front. But this record, it's not an exaggeration. I probably listened to it 1,000 times. I just love it.
Yeah, and this is the good news, man. If you go backwards and count The Stranger, I'm in a good little run here. I go through 83 or 84 before I hit a record I don't like. I'm going to be on a hot streak.
That's pretty great.
Jeff, do it, man.
All right, so this is the last of the artists who make two records in a year. The 70s must be.
Joe Jackson.
Yes, it's Joe Jackson. You're absolutely correct. All right, end of podcast. What's your pick, Timmy?
No, go ahead.
No, sure. Do you want to do Joe Jackson?
I'm excited for you. Look sharp. Go ahead.
So, I Joe Jackson, I absolutely adore, and for a whole bunch of reasons. The songs are great. There's these two records, Look Sharp, the first record, and I'm the Man, the second one, are just full of unbelievably great 3.5 minute songs. They're funny and they're snarky and they have great turns of phrase and they're self-effacing and they're pissed off. It runs the gamut. Joe Jackson's a really interesting story. Joe Jackson is a kid who wakes up one day and realizes all I want to do is play music when he's like 12 years old. And he's a piano player. And then he falls incredibly hard for pub and punk rock. And he's like, how the hell am I going to do this? right? I mean, there's no piano player in the front of a punk rock band. And so he figures out how to position himself as like kind of a sneering, like not really punk rock, more like a pub new wave rocker. And then in the early shows, we just run over to the piano and play it for a second and then run back up to the front of the mic. And what's funny about that is he's a damn fine piano player. Like when he embraces the piano as the central instrument in his music on Night and Day in 82, like he's a hell of a piano player, but he hid it all for the first years. Cause and unlike all the other punk rock bands, he wrote all the parts for all the instruments and asked the guys to play it that way. Like he composed these songs cause he went to music school. And he's like, do the drum fill like this and do it here. And I want you to play the guitar like this. And then this is what the solo should sound like. And so the guys in his band were cool enough to join a band where the front man wasn't the dynamic lead singer. He was the writer and the singer and the MC and the Svengali and everything. And so there's a level of craft to Look Sharp and I'm the Man that other punk music from that era. Joe Jackson gets lumped in rightly with Elvis Costello, Graham Parker, like the kind of Nick Lowe, the singer songwriter guys from that early punk movement. But he, and like Elvis Costello, he's a secret triple threat musician pretending to be just a sneering, angry teenager. And his career is really interesting because of that. But this is before Joe Jackson decides I need to sound completely different record to record to record. And I think kind of starts to become a parody of himself. On these two records, he's just a poor kid from England who's trying to make it in the music business. But the secret weapon.
Sorry, wait. Can you say, define triple threat there? So a writer.
Writer, singer, producer, play multiple instruments, arranger, you know, like.
He's doing it all.
Yeah. And he can speak in real, like Joe Strummer, as much as I love him, isn't going to get a bunch of session guys in front of him and say, okay, this is in B minor. And we're going to, you know, we're going to go to the relative minor. And I mean, he just doesn't think that way, but Jackson is a you know, just a really well-trained musician. But the secret weapon to Joe Jackson's first two records, and the reason I love them so much, is bass player Graham Mabey. Graham Mabey you've heard Graham Mabey.
Yeah, I know it.
He's all over the place. Starts in Joe Jackson's band, and then he kind of plays with anybody he wants through that. If you talk to bass players, if you talk to bass players who like have been playing bass a long time, you ask them who your favorite bass players. Everybody says Entwistle, and everybody like there's guys, right? When anybody asks me who's your favorite bass player, I'm like, you know who I really like is Graham Mabey. And anytime I say that and a guy's eyes light up, we like all the same music. And I've never met a bass player who, when you don't say Graham Mabey, it's like a pass key, like, oh, you actually really care about this instrument. Like Graham Mabey belongs in the short list with Paul McCartney and Mike Mills and Entwistle and Ron Carter from the Miles Davis Quintet. He's a brilliant player. He writes brilliant. And Stang, he belongs on that list. He writes brilliant parts. And he brings a level of energy and propulsion and chops to the Joe Jackson band that no other punk band has. And all these songs are propelled by his unbelievably percussive, sharp playing. And because it's just a trio most of the time, because the guitar player is playing mostly chords, maybe acts almost like a lead instrument on some songs. So before I play like my favorite song, I just want to play you a little bit of Graham Mabey at work.
Yeah, please.
On Got the Time, which is the last song on Look Sharp. And it's kind of it's the equivalent of like a punk rock record's like Freebird. It actually has a bass solo in it, but it's just, the guy is so good. I just want to play a little bit of it here. And then I'll play you what's my current favorite Joe Jackson song. It's just so fun. This is a really fun band. But my favorite song right now, for no reason whatsoever, is the last song on I'm the Man. It's called Friday. And it's just a little throwaway song, but it gives you a great sense of what this band was trying. The band's trying to take the energy of punk rock and the craftsmanship of pop songwriting and push it through this kind of new wave, the sound of its moments, right? So there's a lot of reggae in it. There's a lot of scratchy guitar. There's a lot of buzzing. And then Jackson just, I was just giving all this shit to Billy Joel for not being believable. I believe Joe Jackson. Like, I believe these are songs that are resonant with him and speak to how he feels about things. So Friday's a great song about just working a crap job and just waiting for the weekend. And it's the angry punk rock version of Here Comes the Weekend, or It's Saturday Night and I Just Got Paid. And I just love it. So here's Friday from one of two awesome records from 79 from Joe Jackson.
Look Sharp and I'm the Man by Joe Jackson.
Sounds a little bit like Ben Folds, doesn't he?
Yeah, there's a lot of Joe Jackson and Ben Folds. That's good. But and they sound like the Police. They sound like, I mean, they, you know, there was a moment here where this kind of hyper up tempo, amphetamine fueled, you know, pop rock is called punk rock and new wave, but it probably doesn't. It's probably incorrectly lumped in there in that regard. I mean, like, 3 years later, the guy's singing Breaking Us in Two. Like, he's not a punk rocker by any stretch, but I just love these records. I used to own I'm the Man as in a collection that was 5 7-inch singles. It was an incredible pain in the ass to listen to, but it really captured for me what this record, it's the attempt to write 10 hit singles, really. Like, both these records is not a single song that you could call an album track. They're all reach out and grab you, like, we want this to be as hooky as we can.
And is she really going out with him on one of these two albums?
Yeah, it's on Look Sharp.
I mean, that's not, you know, kind of hyper fast or anything like that. It's just but I believe him in that
song. It's funny too. It's funny.
It's funny.
Yeah. But it also gets you because you're not the gorilla.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know.
Ben Barton, you didn't like Graham Nash. You're Parker. Out on Nick Lowe.
I also don't like Graham Nash, but it was Graham Parker who I didn't like.
It's a good point. It's a good point. You're out on a lot of Lou Graham. You're out on Lou Graham.
Big time. Thank you for that, Timmy.
Where do you land with Joe Jackson?
So Elvis Costello was the gold standard in this area. And Elvis Costello has put out a record or two records in the last 10 years that I was like, wow, I really enjoyed that.
Oliver's
not the case for Joe Jackson. Oh. That being said, Joe Jackson is right there in the B category here and above Nick Lowe. Yeah. No, this stuff is great. These two records are great. The Night and Day has got several good songs on it. The songs are catchier and the players are better. And in particular, like, Jeff's right. If you feel like it, go back and listen how repulsive that bass is. And also how humorous it is. The bass solo was just more bass. You know what I mean? Like, he's not trying to make it sound like a guitar. He's not doing like the Van Halen bass solo.
No.
He's actually just filling it in. And I am a huge sucker for bass-driven songs with tasty guitar parts on top of it, which means I like these records. Like, that's what these records sound like. And I agree. Like, I actually, it's, Jeff, what happened to him, man? Why? What went wrong?
Yeah,
I really don't know. Like, he, you know, he made Big World in 1986, which I thought was a really underrated record, but it's stiffed. And he went from playing Meriwether Post Pavilion to, like, he went from the sheds to the theaters.
Yeah.
And then he made a really bad record in 1992 called Laughter and Lust, which looked like the cover was ugly. It wasn't a good record, had like two good songs on it. And then he just disappeared for like 6 years. And now he makes a record like every 7 years, and they're all the wrong influences. Like, they're super musical and there's lots of diminished chords, and he doesn't kick up a racket. I saw the Joe Jackson Band with Graham Mabey. They played Hardly Strictly when the Megan Band played it. So I had like the artist pass, and I embarrassingly accosted Graham Mabey backstage, and like, you know, I gave him maybe 30 seconds to cool off. I was like, "You're Graham Mabey, and I love you playing." Like, it was not my finest moment, but they, you know, the whole band was great, and they're playing all those old great songs, and Jackson just seemed really tired. Like, I don't know. Like, he looked really old too. He aged dramatically in the 2000s. So I don't know what's going on, but I've been disappointed. Like, I keep waiting. I was really hoping he reunited the original quartet and made a record called Volume 4 in 2004. And it was all 3 minute songs. And I was so excited. And he just lost the touch. Mm. None of the songs are memorable, and none of them had this like just undeniable catchy edge to him.
Because you're a much bigger Elvis Costello fan than I am, but you agree with me, right? I mean, like, he continues to pump out interesting stuff. I mean, it's not all good, but I mean, it's really good.
You can anticipate it being good. You can hope for goodness. There's no, we're beyond that with,
in fact, Costello will wander, like, it's not in the 2000s, but 13 Steps Lead Down. Like,
yeah, that's 94.
He'll break out a rocker. You know what I mean? Like, he'll go ahead and just go old school and then bring it back and then do weird orchestral stuff. But he at least keeps that mix alive. I don't know. Like, I guess I never listened to it. I feel like I listened to the record that was in the mid 80s with the one that you said was underrated. I don't remember that being properly rated.
Yeah.
But after that, I mean, good Lord, he just completely dropped off.
Yeah. No, I agree.
All right. Well, you guys have done well. I think you're on to something with Joe Jackson. I think you're on to something with The Clash. But you came up short in 1979 because I have the best album of 1979. And I know you guys look down on me. I can feel it. I can see it through the Zoom camera.
Timmy, you're in a freaking basement, man. Like, you live in a basement. We can't help but look down.
And you're looking down musically at me because I don't know, play an instrument. I don't know a minor chord or.
For those of you listening to this whining chord at home, Timmy is using air quotes.
Yeah, for sure.
I would just like you guys to remember that even the losers get lucky sometimes. Come on now. Let's go a little Damn the Torpedoes, Jeff Simons, with my favorite song, which I bet you don't know what my favorite song is.
I'm going to guess it's Shadow of a Doubt.
Holy shit, you do know what my favorite song is. Go, baby, go.
Come on, man.
Damn the Torpedoes by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
So good.
You got Refugee, Here Comes My Girl, Even the Losers, Don't Do Me Like That. I mean, it is nonstop on this album. And what you guys were
you were breaking down Jeff Lynne's production of Tom Petty as if it was like shiny and there's no surprises and no urgency. And this particular album has all those kind of fun little Tom Petty moments where Tom Petty just gets to be Tom Petty.
This is Jimmy Iovine producing. It's a whole different universe. Yeah.
Whole different universe.
What is your favorite song on this record?
My favorite song? Oh, Here Comes My Girl.
That's your favorite song?
Yeah.
What do you think mine is?
Oh, gosh. Well, wait, guessing... pause. Don't answer that. Give me a little bit of Here Comes My Girl.
This is a great one.
Sometimes I don't know why.
Is it Even the Losers? Is that your favorite?
I was going to say Refugee.
Don't do me like that.
Oh, that's great. Really? I thought it would be too poppy for you.
2 minutes, 43 it seconds really... in, out. Perfect.
Perfect.
Perfect song.
Perfect song. You know, I was just going to say, like, the reason I know that Shadow of a Doubt is Timmy's favorite is just because it's the version of romance that Tim would like to believe is the case for everyone, right? It's the sweetest song on the record. Like, when she's sleeping, she often dreams in French, but when she wakes up, she don't remember it. You know, like, I just like, I, and Refugee's too hard for Tim. We've got something.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah.
We scary. Both know it. Scary. We don't talk too much about it. Tim's a talker, you know, and then there's too much of a, like, strutting down the street for here, like that watch a walk would make Tim a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, for sure.
Here comes my girl.
And also mumbling. There's too much mumbling. Yeah. I love the mumbling.
That give makes me, God. Give me 15 seconds and don't do me like that.
This is so great. I don't stop there. It's going to be.
I mean,
I love him so.
Turn around, let him go.
Oh, oh good.
Perfect.
So good. And so, I mean, basically, the record's great. I don't have any beef with this record at all. But there's a special place in my heart for the 2 minute, 43 second pop song. That's just like, and also like, it's similar to a great comedy movie where it appears effortless.
Yeah.
You're like, he must just crap these songs out. Like, it must just be the easiest thing in the world for him. Like, he must have written this like in 10 minutes. But then when you examine it a little bit more, you're like, it's so constructed. Like, there's not a missing second, not a missing note.
Dude, that bridge, word is perfect. That bridge when it goes to the C minor to get to the D7 to get back to the G. Unbelievable. And you know how this ended up on the record, right? This is a great story. They're done. Like, they've done all the, like, they've tracked what they think is going to be the record, and Iovine goes out to get a sandwich or something, and they're getting loose, and he's like, oh, let's play Don't Leave Me Like That, which is an old Mudcrutch song from 1971, and Iovine comes in and is like, what was that? He's like, oh, we're just screwing around. He's like, you were doing what now? He's like, oh, this is a song I wrote now.
Who said who and what now?
And he's like, no, that's the fucking song. Go back. And then he makes them record it. And they're like, no, that's old. That's not what we want to do. I can't even believe that that song was almost lost to history.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So great.
Yeah, because other artists would kind of get in the way. It's like, you know what? Let's make it 3 minutes and 10 seconds. And then it's like, well, no, you've lost it. Know when to get out.
That's a great record.
Of your
great,
own
great
way.
Great choice, Tim.
Well done, Timmy.
All right. So, Ben Barton, I'm going to give you homework. It is tomorrow, September 1st. You are a writer, are you not? Yes, you are.
To write a thing.
I am going to give you till Thanksgiving to write the short story of the boy in the stairwell. Clash version, not Harry Potter version. I want to read that story that you told tonight. Jeff Simons, would you read that story?
Oh, well, I read anything Ben writes. I've read his law book, so of course I'd read it.
Dear God, you are a friend.
I'm just kidding. Can I shamelessly self-promote here at the end of the time?
Tell me.
I'm dropping a new single September 10th, which is going to be like 2 days after we drop this podcast, I believe, right?
Okay.
It's going to come out on the 8th. So 2 days from now, you can listen to my new single, Emily. There's a video. There's a new single, and you can pre-save it on Spotify. And
I'm going to do we'll that right see. Now. Emily. And
it comes out September 10th. A week from this, September 10th, so Friday, September 10th. So
meanwhile, your big concert is September 30th, right?
Correct.
Kind
currently
of a record
still on, currently still happening.
We'll a record release party, if you will.
Yep. Yep.
So there's talk of flying out to California for that gig. What would you think? Would you be weirded out if
Are
your
you
podcast
kidding?
Partners were in the
Are
audience?
Are you kidding? First of all, we'll do a podcast live together when you're here, which would be amazing.
That would be so fun.
And then second of all, yeah, I'll put you up. Well, I'd be beyond
put
honored.
Put us up
you
on stage?
You can like report live from it. Like, hey, we're in the back and it's not going super
sure.
well.
I cannot wait to sing backing vocals. This is going to be so much fun.
That will be good.
We're getting the band back together. Let's go.
When do we nice. Have it together?
All right, gentlemen. I will
Timmy,
see you
well
all
done as always,
later.
My friend.
Hey, friends, I'm so sorry you're not going to be partying at Bonnaroo this weekend. I was
I
so
know.
Excited to hear about it.
We'll,
indeed.
Yeah.
June 2022, I'll be there. As soon as they have that thing, I'm going to be there. I don't even
well,
care.
In June, I got, I mean, I'm in for June.
All right. Peace out. Thanks for listening to 50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys here on the Music City Drive-In Podcast Network. If you like this one, go ahead and give us a review at iTunes and check us out on Twitter and Facebook.
Peace. Welcome to Ringside with Ray and Prince. My name is Ray Leonard Jr.
Oh, we got this chair. No, that's just my dad.
My name is Prince Daniels Jr.
Daniels again with a big home.
On this show, we come to humanize
athletes, entertainers, business executives. We're going to see what makes them tick.
Tuesdays, 10 a.m. Pacific time on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll see you there. Peace and power.
Electric Acid.
Hi, I'm Lessa Gaudet, host of Her Extraordinary Life by Design podcast, where we celebrate women who are shaping their lives one extraordinary day at a time. I speak with women from all over the world about what they do and how they are passionately pursuing their dreams and creating meaningful impacts on their communities. So come join us and learn about all there is to learn about these extraordinary women.
Electric Acid.